This is an interview with Judge Alfred T. Goodwin, August 29th, 1986, Tape 23, Side 1.
Before I leave the bar examination, I ought to clarify a couple of terms. One, when I talk about the bar examination, I'm really talking about the multi-state bar examination that's prepared by the Educational Testing Service in Princeton. Mm-hmm. And when I say its validation is good, it's not perfect, but it's constantly being reviewed. And one of the projects of the American Bar Association is constant vigilance and constant validation and re-examination of all of these tests and all of the standards so that we don't get smug and comfortable about our testing or our standards for admission to practice and also our standards for the accreditation of law schools are constantly being reviewed and validated so that we don't ossified, I guess, in the sense that what was good in 1935 or 55 yeah. is good enough for today.
Sure.
There are a lot of social pressures, particularly with racial minorities, who feel that they are being dealt out of the mainstream of the professions of medicine and law because of rigorous entrance requirements for professional school and for admission to practice. Mm-hmm. And we're all very sensitive to the problems of persons whose either language or culture or childhood environment have left them less than well prepared for professional school, and so we try to make sure that none of our exclusionary practices fall disproportionately upon minorities. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, people who don't do well in grade school aren't going to do well in high school, and their chances of success in college are going to be minimal, and they probably won't even get into graduate school.
Yeah.
And it's too late by the time a person is 18 years old and wants to go to college to say, gosh, we've got to do something about reading and writing and vocabulary. It's really too late. And so we run into young people who might be, might have native intelligence, but who haven't been educationally prepared for a rigorous academic discipline. Mm-hmm. And we run into these people from all races and all cultures and all social backgrounds, but the most conspicuous deficits are among urban black children who, for one reason or another, haven't done well in school, in public school. And there's a really dangerous, I think, discrepancy in the number of black professionals compared to their percentage of the population. Let's say that 18% of the population in several of our most populous states, 18 to 20%, are black. Well, it would be in a perfect world, 18 to 20% of our lawyers would be black, but that isn't true. It's more like 1 or 2%. of the lawyers are black. Now, there are a lot of black people who feel that they're not going to get a fair hearing before a white judge, represented by a white lawyer and tried by a white jury. Now, the jury problem has been pretty well solved. We get, in our urban centers, we get probably a higher percentage of black people on the jury than their percentage in the general population, because they don't have as many excuses to get out of jury service.
Yeah.
But we don't have enough black judges, and you're not going to get black judges until you get more black lawyers. And we don't have enough black judges for the black criminal defendant to feel like he's going to see a friendly face in the courtroom.
Yeah.
The only friendly face he sees is the bailiff or a deputy sheriff or somebody. That's not a healthy situation. And the American Bar Association is worried about it, and they're working on it. And one of our biggest projects this year is to recruit more bright students to go into pre-law and law school, and so that we can get a bigger pool of black law school candidates. It's right now, there's real, almost, vindictive competition to get black students who can do the work. All kinds of scholarships are available. The good schools, the prominent, the well-known law schools, can skim the country. They can go nationwide and admit to their law schools the highest scoring black applicants, and they can just skim the cream right off the top of the country, and they can get all of the students that are available. I'm talking about maybe 150 students nationwide, yeah, that are really able to do legal work of a high quality at the entry stage of first year law students. And those kids can go to Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Duke, Stanford, Cal, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, etc., and they can go with a full ride, just like field goal kickers. they're in great demand. Well, what that does is it leaves for schools like the University of Oregon and Santa Clara and Lewis and Clark and University of Washington and Illinois and Indiana and so on, it leaves them a bunch of C minus or C students who want to go to law school but are going to have a hard time keeping up with their class.
Yeah.
And yet there's tremendous pressure to take those students, even though their admission scores on their testing, and these tests are pretty well validated as to their ability to predict what a student will do in law school, the law school admissions test. But the students with low scores are getting admitted because they're of their race. You know, the white kids would not be admitted with a score of 20 or 25 or 28 on an LSAT, the law school admission test.
Mm-hmm.
The perfect score on an LSAT is 50. And a good score is a 38. Well, the average entry scores of white students at Yale is about 45. Now, black students with a 38 will get in anywhere they wanted, practically anywhere in the country. But there are probably only 100 black kids in the United States that are going to have a 38 or higher on their LSAT.
Yeah.
So we come to a school like Howard University in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Where's Howard going to get its students?
Yeah.
They're going to be kids who couldn't get in at Harvard, Yale, Virginia, Duke, Michigan, Cal, Stanford, and so on. They're going to have an entry average at Howard somewhere down in the low 20s. Well, that's not, doesn't make for a stimulating entry class of freshman law students. I mean, these are all of them just hanging on by their fingertips to stay in law school. And if you have a conscientious faculty that's going to flunk out students who can't do the work, the faculty is going to be terribly torn about how do we manage with this kind of a law school. So they keep them in and graduate them. And then their bar passage rates are in the 20% level or lower. And you've got a private law school that's tuition driven and accredited by the American Bar Association and is constantly in trouble. Now, if these reports or remarks of mine are made public within the next couple of years, it could be dangerous for Howard or other schools like that I've mentioned, but because it isn't going to help their recruiting.
Yeah.
But if these remarks are not made public for a while, it'll be history, and whatever's going to happen to Howard will have already happened.
Yeah.
But you can see what affirmative action and integration has done for the all-black colleges. It hasn't been good for them.
Yeah, that's a very cogent explanation. So the incentive of the strong law schools to make these nationwide searches for exceptional black students is the pressure of affirmative action? Do they have any other incentive
They're doing it because they want to do it. I think a lot of affirmative action is motivated by a desire to do the right thing. It also looks nice on your reports that you file with your various educational agencies and so on. If you can write a report for HEW that shows that you've got 12% of your student body are black, you're looked upon with favor when it comes time to give out grants and research money and so on. Mm-hmm. So there are all kinds of self-serving reasons why doing good also pays. But a lot of the motivation is really a good solid desire to do something about the injustice of the past particularly, I'm talking about blacks because particularly the black people have been the ones that have been underrepresented in the most egregious ways and discriminated against. Now there's a terrific problem with the Spanish-speaking minorities, but that's a different kind of a problem, and it's a cultural problem, and it's partly a function of the failure of the legal profession to have any status in Spanish-speaking Latin American countries. You know, lawyers in Latin America are not really held in very high regard, and sometimes for very good reasons. They're frequently in cahoots with corrupt politicians, and the private law sector in a poor country doesn't usually commend itself to the general population. And the poorer the country, the less contact the people have with the legal profession. Mm-hmm. And in Mexico, for example, there are a few distinguished lawyers in the big cities who are highly respected and ethical and pillars of the community, but they're a very small minority. It's not at all the way it is in the United States, where lawyers tend to be scoffed at a little bit that made the butt of jokes at the Lions Club luncheons, but they're basically highly respected people. Mm-hmm. That is not true in Central and South America, and Latin America. So you have a Spanish culture whose roots are in Mexico or Cuba, where in the last 30 years they haven't had much of any contact with decent lawyers either. You're not going to have a lot of family dinner table talk about how nice it would be if little Miguel should go to law school. Mm-hmm. The role models simply aren't there. Mm-hmm. So so little Miguel or Jesus or Jose grow up and they don't want to be lawyers, they want to be bankers or automobile dealers or proprietors of businesses, but or doctors, but they don't want to be lawyers. And so we have a problem recruiting qualified Spanish-speaking people, but it's a different problem than the black situation. The Asian minorities aren't really minorities anymore. They're just Mickey Mouse minorities that are used for statistical purposes to show that we're doing great. You know, the school can report X number of Asians in their law school student body and say, look what a great job we're doing recruiting minorities, but they're not really minorities because they're making them. You know, they're mainstreaming and making it fine. Half of the A students in the best high school in San Francisco are Asians. The joke down there is the other half are Jews. I mean, it's not a, you haven't got any kind of affirmative action in James Russell Lowell High School because it's a competitive school and it's like the Bronx High School of Arts and Science where it's a competitive exam to get into that high school. And you're going to end up with ethnic and demographic populations that are totally out of character with the main stream in that city. And in San Francisco, the smartest prep school kids are Chinese. And they're the ones that are going to get all the A's and, when they go to college, too. It's not all the A's, but a lot of them. I mean, so calling them a minority is ridiculous. They're not, they are a numerical minority in the population, but they're not an oppressed minority in terms of academic opportunity.
There still is, however, a similarly large discrepancy between their percentage of the population and their existence in different professional categories.
Yeah.
I suppose, though, that you see that as just something that's in the next couple of decades is probably going to correct itself.
Chinese language students who wish to become lawyers can without any difficulty. Their problem is that they want to be physicists and high-tech. They go into electronics and engineering and medicine because they see better income. Their C students become bankers. But anyway, the minority thing is a big problem in the American Bar Association because we're conscious of our image as a white plantation type board of overseers of the legal profession, and we're trying to change it.
This effort at recruitment that you mentioned to bring more, particularly black students, into law schools. Now, was that a measure that came out of the section on legal education that you were chairing?
Yeah, but it's evolved over a period of many years. I don't claim any credit during my year as chair. It's an ongoing thing. Actually, some of the leadership in that movement has come from other sections of the ABA as well. The Board of Governors, the Section on Human Rights have contributed to it. Dean Redlich of New York University Law School and Cal Udall, a lawyer from Arizona, have teamed up to run a task force on minority recruitment. Mm-hmm. And they've done a lot to sensitize the profession about the need to recruit in the high schools and to try to present programs in the undergraduate, high school and undergraduate colleges to she let black students know that if they make good grades and study hard, they have just as good a chance to become lawyers and judges as anyone else. And it's a selling job, because the kids don't know that. In fact, when they first hear it, they don't believe it. And you have to keep telling them.
Yeah.
And we need to educate a whole class of high school counselors. High school counselors in some parts of the country have a propensity to send black students off to basketball practice and not even talk to them about law and medicine and so on. And that has to be remedied.
Well, as someone who's had an opportunity to look at standards of legal education really throughout the country pretty closely, how do you see Oregon law schools measuring up here in 1980s?
Well, Oregon is blessed with a good pool of student applicants or applicants who want to go to law school, who are more or less captive students because they like to live in Oregon. And so we get a good applicant pool here, and our schools are producing good lawyers, but they're not great law schools. I mean, Oregon and the three schools in Oregon, Oregon and Lewis and Clark and Willamette, are good, solid, pedestrian law schools. None of them has enough money to put on a really enriched program like you'd find at Stanford or even University of Washington. The University of Washington has a lot more money for its law school than the University of Oregon has, and a lot less competition for good students, because the only two schools in Washington that offer a JD degree, one is Gonzaga over in Spokane, which mm-hmm. is a good garden variety middle-sized law school, but it's not a great law school. It's turned out some good and great lawyers, but it's on a field with University of Chicago and Harvard and Yale and Columbia, NYU, Pennsylvania. Gonzaga wouldn't, or Oregon, or Willamette, or Lewis and Clark wouldn't have any chance to compete. But the only other school in Washington State is Puget Sound in Tacoma, which is about where Lewis and Clark was 10 or 15 years ago in terms of its development. It's coming up fast, but it's not there yet. It's a good school, but it's not a great school. Mm-hmm. University of Washington is very good. I think it compares favorably with UCLA, USC, and schools of that size and funding. Berkeley is probably not quite as good as its reputation. I mean, Berkeley has a long-standing reputation as an elite, highly selective, highly competitive law school, and it is, and it's good. But I don't think its students are that much better than those at Washington or UCLA. Mm-hmm. Stanford is in a little bit of a class by itself on the West Coast because it's well endowed with money. It can offer good scholarships. It can compete for students against any law school in the country, and does. It competes for faculty against any law school in the country, and does, and gets good faculty. I think Stanford probably, in terms of the enrichment of their program and the student faculty ratio and so on is probably the strongest law school on the West Coast. But there's, we our law, our court hires law clerks from all these schools. We hire clerks from Washington, Stanford, Berkeley, UCLA, USC, Davis, Santa Clara, Oregon, occasionally somebody from Willamette, or Lewis and Clark, and San Diego, University of San Diego, and so on. It, those students are the top of their class in each of these schools, and they're all pretty competitive. It's very difficult to look at the work of a Stanford student and say, well, this kid went to Stanford and this kid went to Willamette, because they're all A students. They're all at the top of their class. Mm-hmm. It's where you get down into the C students that you start seeing a difference. And unfortunately, everybody isn't an A student. And so, you know, you do have lawyers graduating from some of the less affluent law schools who probably aren't as well prepared as they should be. And not because the law school is not affluent, but just because in the competition for bright students, the brightest have gone somewhere else, probably.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that a C student at a first-rate law school would be considerably stronger than
probably,
a C student at a mediocre law school.
Yeah. And they're perceived that way by the hiring partners in the big law firms.
Mm-hmm. You use the adjective enriched a couple of times to sort of indicate what is special about first-rate law school.
It's the
kinds of things?
It's the faculty, the scholarship, uh-huh. the production of the faculty, the books they've written, the articles that they've written, the articles that they've had students help them write. I mean, if you're a student at a law school where you can help a professor write his new book or her new treatise on some special field of law, that student is going to get an experience that is going to last a lifetime.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you're running on a fast track, you're going to train better than if you're running on a slow track. And if you're working for a Boris Bitker at Yale in the tax field, or a Tony Amsterdam at NYU, or in clinical legal education, or a Gunther at Stanford in constitutional law, or Paul Brest, or even the dean at Stanford. And deans usually aren't the well, a good dean is an administrator, and a good classroom professor isn't necessarily a great administrator. It's amazing when you get a combination like John Hart Ely at Stanford, who is a tremendous legal scholar in constitutional law, and is also a pretty good dean. I don't know why he wants to be dean. He takes time away from the things he's really good at, which are teaching and writing. But he's a good dean, and at Stanford, a good dean is also a fundraiser. So here's John Hart Ely, one of the really great legal scholars in the country, going out and raising money for endowing chairs and stuff. But he's good at it. But you see, that's what I mean by a school. And when you have that kind of talent on the faculty, and then the students can work with those people on a one-on-one basis, the students get a tremendous intellectual excitement from that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there just isn't enough of that intellectual excitement to go around to 175 law schools that we look after in this country.
This is a bit of a divergence, but would you consider Oregon's Orlando Hollis to be a comparable combination?
Orlando is an amazingly effective classroom professor. He never wrote much.
Yeah.
He didn't publish a lot of, as far as I know, he I haven't looked him up in the index of legal periodicals, but I doubt if you'd find a very long list of publications. He was a very poor dean in one respect. He couldn't delegate anything, and he made all decisions himself. They were usually wise decisions, but he didn't develop a real collegial faculty a governing system. He didn't spend the money the legislature gave him for law school faculty, and so he'd turn it back. He was terribly parsimonious. He didn't have any vision about the growth that was coming in at the period.